So the fourth noble truth is interesting. And often, by the way, the four noble truths, there's a medical metaphor used, like a doctor. And the first one is, you know, there's a symptom. That's the first one. There's analysis of the cause or what's causing sickness is the second one. The possibility to cure is the third one. And the fourth is like the prescription, the medication, what you do. So the fourth noble truth is essentially where the Buddha told us the way out, how to be free, how to accomplish this noble vision, in particular of Nibbana, which would mean like internal freedom despite external conditions, or even ultimate freedom despite internal conditions too, because we can have all kinds of emotional internal conditions, but to be free no matter what. So the fourth noble truth is in turn made up of the noble eightfold path. And since I have 10 minutes, this is a interesting thing to approach. Noble eightfold path. So I'm going to offer a few entry points that might click for you that will help these eight become useful tools instead of just a list. But I'm going to rattle off the eight, or name the eight, just to so you know what we're talking about. They are right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And, oh, by the way, they're on Wikipedia, so if you want to go look, it's out there. Note that there's a way that these eight move towards deeper and more subtle actions, in particular toward meditation, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So there's a trajectory there, and they're supported by the more ethical and practical considerations earlier on in the list. So I'm going to offer three quick perspectives on these eight that might prove useful. One is, in this classical sequencing, the series starts with right view and right intention before it even starts going anywhere, which is interesting because this speaks to the importance of a sense of direction, of knowing where we're trying to go before we start to go there, which is part of the paradox of the path, because in a sense, well, we don't know where we're trying to go because we'd be there. But no, actually, to have a sense of where you're going before we start to go there is really helpful. That's why there's teachings. That's why the Buddha taught for 40 years. That's why we're doing this. So right at the beginning, this right view and a sense of cause and effect is built into right view, and then right intention, like, yeah, we're going to head in that direction. And this is always a delicate balance because we're heading towards something which is beyond cognitive understanding. We're heading towards waking up. But at the same time, we use our tools, our brains, our minds, our understanding to head in that direction. And one reason why is that often the very direction of awakening is counterintuitive, and we need teachings to get us over the hump, the whole arena of not-self. It's just like, it just comes right up against, we don't think it's true until we look deeper. But the teachings help us get there. So that's why these first two are so important and so brilliant. This whole this Noble Eightfold Path is just brilliant. The more you get into it, it's like, oh my God, you really nailed it. The second key perspective has to do with the quality of our actions, how we live, the ethical choices that we make, and how essential those are for the potential for Nibbana. And these three, there's three of them. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And it's really mind-blowing when you think about it. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha came up with this. And here we are in 2022. It completely rings true. I mean, it's really astonishing. It's like not, you know, age-defined. It rings true right now. I mean, think about when we sit down, when we try to practice with one of our colleagues was just talking about it, how we're often beset by inner storms. Stuff comes up. And what the Buddha is suggesting is that these three areas of choice and the attitudes behind them are essential if we're to calm our storms, for our practice to go anywhere, how we live, the choices we make are right in the bedrock of how we do our practice. We can't mess this stuff up and have meditation work. you got to really work right here to have it work. So right action refers to core ethical choices. Refraining from killing, from stealing. Do a time check here. Yes. Okay. Refraining from killing, from stealing, from lying, from sexual misconduct, and from abuse of intoxicants. Those are the five precepts. And just to train in those is essential to make any progress at all. Otherwise, you know how it is. When you start to settle down, if we're messing up, we'll be plagued by it. And ethical choices were crucial 2,500 years ago, and maybe even more so now, because our culture has created this kind of high-tech empowerment. You know, this exaggerated reward system for financial success that encourages people to ignore ethical choices completely. And they're kind of buffered. You get really rich, you can get away with it for a while. And so it's really something to be conscious of. But the key here is that the core of ethical behavior is not harming others for the sake of our own self-aggrandizement. And if we're to be free of grasping and clinging, if we're to experience the cooling of nibbana, we have to stop putting ourselves first. We got to drop that. We got to put others first. If we keep putting ourselves first, it just traps us. So it is really incredibly practically important to behave ethically. And right speech is so important here in 2022, because we live in this crazy world of digital media where multiple forms of speech, they flash around the globe in a nanosecond, causing untold damage unless there's care taken. Maybe in the Buddhist time, this is more like one person speaking to another, but now it's huge and powerful, and it really behooves us to be even more mindful about what we're doing. Right speech is abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. So all those things, right? You encounter those in your life. Idle chatter, I love that one. It doesn't do anything to take us deeper. We just sit around and tell our stories to each other over and over again, but it doesn't help us see. And that's so contemporary, you know? All four of those. We all encounter them in ourselves and in others all the time. So you can see the ethical component here, how we wouldn't lie or say something abusive unless we were somehow trying to get ahead of someone else. There's a whole lot of positioning built in how we handle speech. So if we drop it, drop it. That's what we got to do to be free. That's why the Buddha talked about it. Right livelihood. That's really amazing how relevant it seems now. Because, you know, the time of the Buddha was this far simpler agrarian society. It kind of blows my mind he even came up with this. I mean, he was in circles of political power. But the short list in the suttas is, no trading in weapons, no trading in living beings, or meat, or liquor, or poisons. And man, all of that means a lot here. I mean, think how really, here we are in the Northwest. It's a region based on factory farming, tech, and aerospace. And in all those cases, you got to be careful navigating. You know, if you have a livelihood, you got to be mindful what you're doing. I used to be an aerospace journalist, and I came to know many people who worked for Boeing, who were Dharma practitioners. They're out there, but who carefully steered their careers away from weapon systems. They would not work in the weapon systems. They consciously went to commercial for that very reason. Pretty amazing. And I myself, at one point, I considered writing for an Association of Seafood Companies for a very short, like, nanosecond until I realized, oh my God, all they're doing is killing vast quantities of fish. No, thank you. So the third thing is the way these eight end by emphasizing the importance of our meditation, our contemplative practice, and the way two aspects of this practice are named. And also there's right effort. So it's right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And we know from experience that right effort is needed to get this practice to happen. We're going against the stream, folks. We have to, you know, you have to make a choice to sit every morning to keep cultivating mindfulness. There's effort there. And next is right mindfulness, the very practice that leads to insight, really the core of what the Buddha taught is what leads to insight, seeing the nature of things, which we can do through mindfulness. It's like the punchline of the entire list. But we can't practice without all these others, without right view, and without virtue of action. So we open into mindfulness practice, the clinging is cut through, the attachments are quenched, nibbana starts to rise. And we start to see through mindfulness that everything's impermanent without an inherent self, that everything's unsatisfactory, we can't depend on it. Three characteristics, that's called. We see through that, freedom starts to open up in little bits, like Buddhadasa was saying, little hints.
Kind reminder, Steve.
Thank you. And before we end, I'll just take the very last one, right concentration. You know, we may have noticed there's not a lot of emphasis on concentration in Western Dharma circles. It's appropriate in one way because mindfulness works without concentration, but it's also worth paying attention to that aspect in terms of the Eightfold Path. And if we can cultivate concentration while we're cultivating mindfulness, they help each other out.